What's up, you guys? Back with another episode, and today we are joined by Bob Peck. Bob is the author of the book Original Sin is a Lie, a book where Bob explains the teachings of Jesus Christ and how they overlap with other renowned mystics such as the Buddha, Krishna, and Paramahansa Yogananda, to name a few, and how these teachings may have been misinterpreted and misused throughout time. Bob is also the director and producer of many festival award-winning documentaries that can be found on his Mind Heart Lens YouTube channel. My favorite of those documentaries being The Kingdom Within, which is a film where Bob interviews mystics and spiritual teachers of many different faiths and practices about their differing views on yoga and God and how to go about interacting with the divine. Bob is also a religious studies scholar, a father, a husband, and a mystic. And today he is the latest guest on the Don't Think Breathe podcast. Bob, thank you for sitting down with me today, man.
Thanks so much, Dalton.
Yeah.
Appreciate that. Today.
Yeah, man. So how you been? We're just sort of meeting each other, man. What's going on in your world?
I've been good, man. I've been good. Like I was just telling you, I'm working on a new pod, or basically the kind of the resurrection of my previous podcast. Thank you for knowing the name. That's I'm flattered. The Beware House Show. People that really love Be Here Now even didn't get it. Like they were like, Beware House. Wait, what? It was like, it's a joke.
Yeah.
No. On the Ram Dass book that everyone's heard of.
It's a nice
and
twist.
So, and it was based on like an artist poster. And so anyway, the new name my wife came up with, Karmic Relief. So dropping real soon, but
well,
yeah,
Karmic
I've been busy.
Good too. I mean, I like it, but I did yeah. Like Beware How.
Thank you.
It's brilliant.
Appreciate it. Mm-hmm. But yeah, just interviewing a bunch of people, you know, and kind of was lucky enough to go on podcasts last year and went on a few, and it was really, really enjoyable to talk to people and you know, hear their stories and vice versa. And I said, you know what, Original Sin is a Lie took me about 5 years of intentional piecing together to write. And so I do want to write another book, more books, but it doesn't make sense right now for me to go back into it. Probably the next couple of years, I'll get started on it. But it's a good time to like podcast and like meet people, meet interesting human beings that are in the space. So that's what I'm up to. And alongside, like you said, husbandry, fatherhood, sonship,
keep you busy,
community member, tech worker. I work at Meta in my day job. So a lot going on.
Yeah, cool. What inspired you to pick up the podcast again?
Yeah, it was mostly just really enjoying how little amount of work you have to do.
To create it and just...
Original Sin is a Lie has like, I think, 25 pages of citations. So, I mean, that took me 9 months.
Yeah.
Just to format and cite like a MLA format, you know, whatever. And I'm hard work's fine, but also... just showing up with coffee and talking to the homies is easier. And it's my favorite activity is like sitting and talking. So it makes sense.
And even like producing them and putting them together is not that.
It's not that hard.
It's not that hard. Yeah.
I've lived in, as you know, you're very kind to shout out Kingdom Within. I've lived in Adobe Premiere for 15 years. So I ain't scared. I'm trying to read, trying to reduce my screen time, just like everyone else.
What is a mystic? You define yourself as a mystic, and
I do, which is paradoxical because mystics hate labels. It is a really good question because I think it does get misunderstood by folks that aren't proximate to spirituality. I think what I'll start by saying what it isn't, which is like magic. Like it's kind of unfortunate that term has like extended into like magic, or like magic with a K, and like there's some overlap of magic with a K of like Western esoteric traditions with mysticism, but generally speaking, mystic just means internal spiritual seeker. It's every religious tradition has exoteric and esoteric. So exoteric is the traditional institution that is the church, the mosque, you know, the community that's built around this formal religious structure. And that's the exoteric. And that's fine. Mm-hmm. And that's, some people need that. And also, there's an alternative in every major faith tradition, which is the esoterics. In Hindu, in Islam, they're called the Sufis. In Christianity, there's a variety. The Gnostics were early on. They're not really around anymore. There's kind of a resurgence. But the contemplatives within Christianity, Judaism is called Kabbalah or Kabbalah. There's a level of sometimes secrecy around it because it's kind of purposefully not for the masses necessarily in like the esoteric traditions, but it's not in like an exclusive way of saying we're better than, at least in my view. It's more of just to say you don't teach calculus to a kindergartner, basically. Mm-hmm. You know, it's like it's for folks that are on the spiritual study path and things like that. So yeah, I mean, I think and generally mystics, it actually comes from the Greek word mu, meaning mute. So it's all about silence and connecting with God. Rumi says, I looked for the divine in churches, temples, and mosques, and I found it in my heart. You know, it's this internal inner work.
So it's someone who looks for that, like God, like within them.
Yeah. Within us and within everything else. Yeah, exactly. Okay. I think it's the more traditional religious, it's almost like it's, he's on a throne and that's about it, you know, and it's that was never really satisfactory for me and for so many others, you know, where we're just going, isn't it in everything? Isn't it in the laugh of the baby?
So that's what the belief is that it's just within all things. And
yeah,
there's nothing that anything or anyone has to do for it to be there. It is just there.
That's well put. I mean, there's definitely a diverse arrangement of like where and what exactly God is among mystic traditions, but yes, I mean, there's a nice term called panentheism, which is referenced in Kingdom Within by Stephen Phillips, who says, you know, essentially it's pantheism, which is God is in everything, but there's an en after pan that implies transcendental. So it's God is everything and beyond everything.
Okay.
And everything means material. So everything in kind of atomic, cellular, molecular structures in this world, God is in that and also beyond it. And then non-duality, I mean, they say you have diverse opinions because in non-duality, God actually isn't in the material. God is only the transcendental. And we're kind of stuck in this godless material form, if you will. And at the same time, what of course says is God is in everything I see. God is in everything I see because God is in my mind. So it's like God actually isn't in the atoms, but God's in our consciousness. And our consciousness is perceiving the atoms. So, yeah, so there's nuance to where and exactly what God is. But I think, coming back to the initial point, like, yes, God is definitely not just bearded sky daddy, to quote Molly Adler.
Would Christianity, is Christianity considered a non-dual or
there's definitely non-dual mystics within Christianity.
So it's that's not really,
but it's
defined
not
clearly. That's like people have there's an argument going on there.
Yeah, I mean, traditional Christianity is at odds with non-duality for sure, because it says that God created the world. God is like,
sure,
you know, active in all. Everything that we're doing, and there's this war between light and dark kind of in some traditional Christianity, which is at odds with non-duality and mysticism, I think, in general. So, you know, ironically, I don't know how well I make the case in my book, but I do consider Jesus a non-dual mystic. And Gospel of Thomas plays into that, which is another thing. We're just kind of jumping right in, but Gospel of Thomas is one of the Jesus Seminar called it the fifth gospel. So it's very close to the New Testament gospel. It's not in the Bible, but it's kind of like the one that is the closest to the Bible without being in it. And there's a variety of reasons for that. But if you read Gospel of Thomas, which we just discovered in 1948 that we've known about, that, you know, some scholars basically say is as early as the New Testament Gospels. It might even predate the Synoptics, Dalton. The Gospel of Thomas is very, very legit.
The Synoptics, were those the original Gospels?
The first three. Yeah, Matthew, Mark, and Luke are the Synoptics. And then John is the fourth. It's outside of that. And so some people, Thomas is kind of in that close proximity, and he says things like, chop a block of wood and I'm there, pour out a, you know, vase of water and I'm there. He says, if you bring out what is within you, it will save you. If you do not bring out what is within you, it will destroy you. You know, it's like, it's a very mystic, kind of Jungian inner work type of stuff, and it also, the reason it's, we know that it's very close proximity to the Bible is because it references the Bible a lot, it has shared stories, the wedding garment, tell me what I'm like, the mustard seed, the greatest hits from the New Testament are also in Thomas. So we know it's the real deal.
So do we have an idea of when we think it was written?
Yeah, it's a great question. And like, this is one of my favorite things to talk about. So thank you for asking. The Gospel of Thomas version that we have in its completion is in a language called Coptic, which is an ancient Egyptian language. Coptic Christians. In fact, Coptic Christians still exist. It was written very likely in the 4th century, the 300s, the one we have, which was buried under a boulder, you know, in Egypt, like it near a monastery, basically. We don't know much about who buried it, but it's probably because in the 4th century, that's when Christianity became tied to the state of Rome and it became the state institution. So that's when they really started burning books. And, you know, shout out to the monks that buried these books, because we wouldn't have them otherwise. It's 50 different texts, codices in 50 texts, sorry, 13 codices in that discovery, the Nakamati Library. The reason we think Thomas is so early is because we know that it was based off of an earlier Greek text. So, you know, 4th century Coptic is the version we have, but what we understand it to be based off is a much earlier version that we don't have. And the reason that the most compelling evidence for Thomas being so early is because there's a few reasons. I'll start at the top here. Sorry guys. I'm rambling a little bit with my Thomas, but it's just 'cause I'm so excited about it. One is its format. So it's just sayings of Jesus. It's 114 sayings. And it says, Jesus said, dot, dot, dot. Jesus said, dot, dot, dot. So it's extremely simple in that, you know, the teachings themselves are very complex and interesting and mystical and contemplative. But you can read it in 45 minutes. You know, it's just 114 different kind of proverbs. And that implies early, right? Because you have...
Had to have been.
Right. Sure. Gospel of Mark is pretty complex. You know, even the first gospel has a sophisticated narrative. It has different, you know, events and characters that show up later and influence the story. Thomas is just bullet points of Jesus' teachings. secondarily, I think it's around 40% of Thomas overlaps with Matthew and Luke, right? And I'm interested in the stuff that doesn't, like the chop the block of wood line, for example. And there's some mind blowers in there. But when Thomas does overlap with Matthew and Luke, the Thomas version is simpler and smaller and more reductive. And that's another really good case for it being as early, if not earlier, you know, to point to the idea of Luke and Matthew having Thomas and then expanding on it, you know, adding a little more. Like, for example, the one about, it's one about how a doctor can't heal the ones who know him. Like a prophet is never accepted in his hometown. It's kind of a famous idea from the New Testament. In Thomas, it's like, that's it. It's like a doctor doesn't heal those who know him. A prophet isn't accepted in his hometown. It's like two or three sentences. And then in Matthew and Luke, it's much longer. It's like five sentences. So it's like a doctor isn't accepted because he knows the different people that he knows and they don't trust that he did. Like, it's an extensive, more extensive version in the Bible. So it's a pretty good, it makes a pretty good case for being as early, if not earlier, and, or at least what Matthew and Luke are basing their work off of also had Thomas, you know, or like it was in that conversation that early. Mm-hmm. It's very unlikely that it was like 100 years later and then there's like no plot and they're simpler parables.
Yeah. Now, like, why do you think that it's important that we know that this was written earlier on? Why would that matter that we're discovering this now?
Yeah, that's a great question. I mean, Jesus is the source of Christianity as a wisdom tradition, right? And so proximity to him is really important. When you get 100 years later, that's different writers, it's different authors, it's different teachers that are interpreting him. And look, we're interpreting him 2,000 years later. So, you know, we're not in control of when we show up, you know, at least on some level, right? But if you're trying to understand the teachings of the master, which is what I'm trying to do, I'm interested in the earliest versions. And I'm interested in when it's changed and why it's changed. And so, you know,
you mean like the context, what was going on during that time?
Right.
Why did they take the teachings of this great influential person and then maybe twist them a little bit to fit the times and maybe they're
it's politics.
Yeah.
You know, it's politics. It's like, and it's so interesting to me because that man and that book he's the most popular human being in the history of civilization. That book is the most influential in history of civilization. Like, it's not irrelevant. You know, it's like informed, you know, certainly Western thought, but even global thought for the last, you know, 2,000 years, right? And so that's always intrigued me. I remember going to Bible scholarship classes, and you very generously introduced me as a Bible scholar. I'm a student of Bible scholarship, respectfully, but I am a you know, passionate student. And I remember leaving those classes and seeing like a poster for the church. And then, like, you know, I would walk past churches, leaving, learning about the difference between Mark, Matthew, Luke, and John, and like distinctions and why. And, you know, to your point around why they're different and what are some examples of some differences, I write about in the end of Original Sin's Law, I think it's like the second to last chapter, the parable of the wedding garment, which is kind of a strange story in Matthew. It's a story that Jesus tells. It's in Matthew and Luke and Thomas. And I reprint the whole thing in the book. And I actually start with Thomas, then Luke, then Matthew. And you can see version A, version B, version C of Jesus' story. And again, it's much simpler in Thomas. And it's a little less crazy in Thomas. It's more straightforward. I'll paraphrase it. Basically, Jesus tells a story of there's a rich man who wants to throw a party. And he tells his servants to go invite people in the town to come. And in Thomas, they say, I'm too busy. You know, thanks for the invite. Check you later. And, you know, the two or three invitees basically all decline for various reasons, usually for like having to work. It's like, I can't make your party. I have to work, bro. And the king is disappointed. And he says, go, he tells the servant, like, go out and invite everybody. Right. Because, the food's going to go bad. You know, like, let's get everybody in this party. Everybody's invited. And it's a shame that people are working and they're missing this party. And essentially the interpretation is, from the mystic standpoint, is we're caught up by the world. You know, God is inviting us to the party of awakening, of true knowledge of our true reality. And we can't go to the party because we're working. Mm-hmm. You know, we're focused on the material world too much. We're blinded by it. Mm-hmm. And it's a beautiful teaching. It's very simple. And then Luke, it becomes a wedding, I think, is the jump, the first jump there. To my memory, you can Google it. And the king, when they decline, is a little angrier. Like, he's more upset than he is in Thomas. And it's a little longer, but it's not too long. Matthew's version of the wedding garment is insane. Like, they, when not only do the invitees decline the invite, they kill the servants.
Mm.
And it's like they go to war, like it's a battle. And the folks who the king basically says, like, not only are they not invited, like, let's kill them. And then this guy comes to the wedding and he's wearing the wrong garment. He's wearing the wrong costume, or the, you know, the wrong outfit. And the king kicks him out and he says, throw him in, basically throw him to hell. And throw him where there's weeping and gnashing of teeth. Like, it takes a dark turn in the Matthew version. And my point in the book, and like writing about that one specifically, is that Matthew's gospel was written in Galilee in the post-temple Judean period. So the temple is destroyed in 70 by Rome. The Roman army comes into Jerusalem and destroys. They siege the city. They destroy Jerusalem. There was a revolt against Rome by the Jews in the late 60s, which is when the Gospels are being written. And the whole point is that Rome destroys the temple. And so the Jewish religion at that period is like existential crisis. Like, they have, it's an extremely dark few decades for the Jews in particular in that period, right when Matthew is being written. Right in Galilee, and it's very fierce sectarian division. So the Pharisees, the Jesus following Jews, they're fighting for believers. You know, it's a very fierce. Paul was a Pharisee who was, you know, going around talking shit about Jesus and before his mystical experience. So it makes sense, Dalton. It's like, of course, Matthew's version is going to be more political. It's going to be angrier. It's because it's reflecting the time. It's mm-hmm. reflecting the cultural and political climate. But you're not going to hear that on Sunday.
Mm-hmm.
You know, it's yeah. like, I didn't go a ton, but I never heard that, you know, and most Christians that I know, you know, you go for like a 15 minute sermon, you know, and it's like, but it's about the pastor's childhood, and, you know, and it's fine. And mm-hmm. there's inspiring sermons, and, you know, you can't generalize American Christianity because there's great parts of it and not great parts of it, but you're not going to get a really deep historical, political unveiling, you know. There, because that's not the purpose. The purpose is to continue the kind of, you know, some of the keep the tent poles standing, if you will, in the storm of the 21st century.
Yeah. And I think the reason it's important to understand that the teachings in the Bible change throughout time is because, I mean, so many people, like in your book, you talk about how it's view it as that it's this infallible doctrine.
Right. Which is hilarious.
And yeah. I mean, yeah. And I want to talk about that a lot. Like, because if we truly like believe that, it's kind of hard to grow as.
I think it's the first step to freedom for Christians that have that belief, because it's impossible to have a realistic look at the text. And it's also pretty impossible. It's damn hard to appreciate other religions and other spiritual paths.
Yeah.
If you think that your book is infallible, without flaw, without error, you know, I mean, that's actually idolatry, that you're worshiping a thing. You're worshiping, you know, look, I appreciate scripture. I appreciate spiritual texts. I've read them. I've read most of the major world religious sources of information and wisdom and knowledge. I'm not enlightened, and I'm not embodying them or anything. Don't get it twisted. But at the same time, like, when you read the spiritual text, you can appreciate them and you can understand them. And if you're tied up tight with one, that's the supposed quote unquote perfect thing, when it's not, when there is real contradictions in it, and they're, you know, and they're not massive. You know, I've had commenters that say, like, you know, that's not really a difference. Like, for example, when Jesus flips the money changers tables in the temple, right? There's folks are like bartering and gambling, essentially. They're like currency exchange. They're basically doing like some banking. They're doing financial operations in the temple in Jerusalem. And Jesus is not thrilled about that. And he famously flips the table to say, get out of here. This is God's thing, which is slightly out of character for him. But anyway, it's in two gospels, so we'll let it slide. We'll try to integrate it. But it might not have happened. But let's just say it did. It is what gets him killed in Mark. It's essentially the last thing in his ministry before the arrest. It's the last thing kind of in the public square, in the public eye, that gets him killed. You know, the Sanhedrin, the church leaders, are right there. They have a close relationship with Pilate. They have a close relationship with the Roman administration. And that's, you know, that's how they get rid of the guy. And that's in Mark. That's the earliest gospel of the Bible. In John, when Jesus flips the table, he then begins his ministry in Jerusalem. After that, then he starts traveling. And then he begins his ministry for the next year, couple of years, and comes back to Jerusalem. And so that's significant. Like, when did he flip the tables according to the Bible? In one gospel, it's at the end of his ministry, and another gospel is the beginning. And I had a commenter say, that's not a contradiction. He flipped the table at the beginning and at the end. And I think that that's hogwash, because it's not in both moments in either gospel. He just made that up to say, you know,
it can still be infallible. And yeah,
right. What Bart Ehrman says, Professor Ehrman, who shout out, and like, he is a legit Bible scholar that I reference often. Professor Bart Ehrman at, I believe he's UNC Chapel Hill. And he's kind of like the most public Bible scholar currently, written a lot of great books and lectures and YouTube him. You know, but he says that's what Christian apologists do, is just what that's called. That's called making a mega gospel. Like, you're making a super gospel that doesn't exist if you do that, if you combine all of the different events and things like that. Like, that's not a realistic way to look at these texts. The real way to look at these texts is to understand exactly what happens in each of them and compare and understand their distinctions and differences and what we can learn from them. You know, I mean, it's really fascinating because you could study this stuff your entire life. Like it's as rich of a subject as anything. And there's new, you know, there's new discoveries, there's new awareness. You know, the Nag Hammadi library that we just discovered in the last century, you know, it's not really out there yet. You know, we're still kind of putting it together and piecing it all together. And I don't think every gospel, every book in the Nag Hammadi library discovery is like this, you know, crazy thing, but it's all like, it's all, if you're interested in Jesus, you know, it's like, it's unfortunate to me that Christians are so dismissive. You know, they're so dismissive generally of the Nag Hammadi library, the discovery of this kind of Gnostic canon. And it's like, this is revolutionary. This paints a whole new picture, a fuller picture of our favorite guy from Galilee. You know, how can we not sit here and contemplate this? And the early church fathers said screw the Gnostics pretty early. You know, they basically said, you know, these guys don't get it. But the Gnostics didn't really have a chance to defend themselves. We basically have what are called heresiologists. So Irenaeus and Athanasius, I believe, is the other one. We have these early church fathers who are basically saying, this Gnostic said this and screw him. And da-da-da. Like for 2,000 years, the vast majority of what we knew about Gnosticism and this kind of other interpretation of Jesus was from the haters. Mm. You know, it's like it was from the critics, which is a probably not very reliable information. If you want to understand a school of philosophy, you know, and so there's, I guess what I'm saying is there's all these new developments. There's all of these, there's this very rich environment within academia around early Christianity and early interpretations of Jesus that question this stuff. And so for people to say it's infallible, it's never changed, he's the only way, you know, da, 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 da. It's like, you sound like a pilgrim on the Mayflower right now. Like, it's 2024. Let's really unpack this, mm-hmm. You know.
Were the Gnostics the first to kind of question the teachings or way people were interpreting them or using his message? Is that who the Gnostics were?
Yeah, I mean, they were also extremely early. So Marcion, for example, of Sinope, who is a Gnostic teacher, there's a guy on YouTube that recently said on this podcast that I went on about Gnosticism, said Marcion wasn't a Gnostic. That's ridiculous. Marcion was a Gnostic. No one in Bible scholarship thinks he wasn't, even though he wasn't into the Gnostic mythology, which comes later in the later second century. He was, and he's significant because he was basically the first guy, Dalton, to say, and he's teaching around 120, after early 100s to kind of the first few decades of the second century. He's the first guy to say the God of the Old Testament seems pretty mean. I am a jealous God, you know, endorses ethnocide in places. And yet this God that Jesus is into, the love of the Father falls on the just and the unjust like the rain, he sounds nice. Mm-hmm. You know, what if these are two different gods? And, you know, I think I see a lot of people stumbling into that, like on spiritual gram nowadays, where they're like, whoa, these are like different whole scenes. And it's like, you know, and no offense, the Old Testament God is God of Judaism. So not trying to be disrespectful there. I'm just, you know, paraphrasing Marcion, a 1900-year-old teacher. So he said that, and that was kind of the first. He was a very early Gnostic teacher who was saying Jesus is doing something different. Mm-hmm. Jesus is, Gnostic comes from the Greek word gnosis, which means spiritual knowledge. It means kind of an interior knowledge that Jesus came here to share with us. and came here to, he capped, he, you know, attained it, if you will, you know, shout out Buddhism, shout out Hinduism. You know, there's an Eastern thread in Gnostic, in the Gnostic tradition, because it's kind of like he obtained the knowledge. He became enlightened, if you will, you know, and he's able to transmit that. He's able to share that. And there's variation within the Gnostic tradition also. Gnostic is sometimes used as this like general term, but there's no like Gnosticism proper either necessarily. The best way to distinguish between Gnostics is by teacher. So you have Marcion, Valentinus, Basilides are kind of the big three from the second century. There's the later guy, Mani. And they all have like subtle distinctions. Valentinus and Basilides have this very rich cosmology of like kind of mythological, like how the universe was formed and how we split off from God and how the false God creator, essentially what Gnosticism says is the God of the Old Testament, the Genesis God, who plays a trick on humanity, you know, and says, don't eat the thing, you know, don't eat the apple, bro. That's a malicious figure. And so, and as you can imagine, I mean, the early church, which is trying to, the early church, the orthodoxy, if you will, which orthodox comes from, it means straight teaching. Orthodontist means straight teeth. The straight dudes versus the Gnostic, the internal mystic, internal wisdom dudes. The orthodoxy is saying Jesus is the culmination of this, right? He's fulfilling in Matthew, I come not to destroy, but to fulfill. You know, he's the 2.0, Old Testament, New Testament. Whereas the Gnostics are saying, he's freeing us from it. So I'd say that's a very core distinction. But you know, I'm not necessarily a Gnostic, but I think that they are worth understanding them and understanding how varied early Christian interpretations are. Because like I said, the Gnostics are making these interpretations, you know, within a century mm-hmm. of Jesus's mm-hmm. death. So that's legitimate. I mean, I've seen comments of people, church Christians going, oh, it's Gnostic, and kind of it's dismissing it, you know. It's like, yo, they were there. They were right there. And Thomas, kind of back to Gospel of Thomas, they've called it the Gnostic Gospel of Thomas. It's actually more accurate to say proto-Gnostic, right? Because if it's contemporary with the Synoptics in the 70s, 60s, 70s, and maybe earlier, like we were suggesting earlier, then that's even before, very likely before the Gnostic tradition. So Thomas is, check it out, you know.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
I like talking about this stuff, Dalton. Thank you for letting me blab.
Well, I'm not nearly as knowledgeable as you are, obviously. I don't, many people aren't.
My pleasure, too.
I'm kind of curious, why do you think that today there are so many disagreements still that on like people's interpretations of the Bible? I mean, obviously
like the denominations and everything.
I told a friend of mine that I was having you on the other day, and partly because like, you know, I grew up in a very, not a very religious household. I had religious friends growing up, kind of like you. I've heard your story of growing up and how you went to church so often and that you enjoyed it because of that. You didn't go too much. It wasn't
twice a year.
Face.
You know, mm-hmm. it's like, it's cool if you go twice a year.
Yeah.
You know?
Yeah.
But the community, the music, going every day. Yeah.
But when it's being almost, to me, I don't want to be rude because I do have a lot of Christians that I know and some that will listen to this. It felt like certain things were being shoved down my throat. They just didn't feel true to me.
Yeah.
So what I'm getting at is I was telling my friend, I'm really excited to have you on because you put this, your perspective and your interpretation of the Bible, it seemed to align more with how I felt growing up and how when I was told certain things in the church, you know, to believe this or it just didn't really sit right with me. And so you're a lot more knowledgeable. You're speaking about these things in a way that really resonates with me.
Thank you.
Yeah.
And let me disclaimer too on all this. Like, Jesus to me is one of the most important human beings in history, not because of his influence, not because of his impact. I mean, yes, but because I believe that he attained the highest level of human consciousness. Like, I really honor him. And the reason I'm so interested in all this stuff is because, like, I really want to get as close to understanding his teaching as possible. And it's a real honor for me to help folks, you know, like you said, like, you're not as knowledgeable, but like, it's an honor for me to share kind of like, I've almost become like a Jesus defender.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
In a bizarre way.
Yeah. Cause Christians will see you as like, oh, you're attacking the word of God.
And right.
In reality, it's like, hold on.
It's like, no, I'm doing this because I'm crazy about this guy. And like, I think he's like the big brother of humanity. And I also deeply honor and revere Buddha and really Krishna. It's kind of how my three are Christ, Krishna, and Buddha. And because they're all on that level. I think there's it's called the avatar in Hindu doctrine, or the Buddha in Buddhism, right? It's like, there's a level of attainment that is like pure love. That's like pure unity consciousness, if you will. And Jesus, it's clear to me that Jesus achieved that. And very early on, I have a chapter that says like, why, you know, I kind of do some untangling like we just did around the politics and the differences and some and the dates and all that. And it's also like, then why bother? And it's like, well, you know, definitely this man's teaching is worth sincere contemplation because he tells us to love one another. He tells us to, he forgives his killers, right? Which is one of the most sublime moments in human history, being killed brutally in front of your friends, your mom, your community as an innocent man, and he forgives them. I mean, there's nothing, that's kind of like the final boss of the material world. You know, that's why, in my view, I do believe he actually did resurrect. As a mystic, I believe he broke the veil. When you break the veil of Maya, which I haven't, as I'm not speaking from experience, but you're able to transcend it. You're able to, you know, animate and appear in it in ways, and that's partially informed by Yogananda's work, who writes a lot about that. But, you know, so anyway, thumbs up to Jesus and also thumbs up to Christianity. I mean, there's been Christians in the last 2,000 years that have also, I believe, achieved the highest of heights. And there's been also Christians that have been the most barbaric human beings in history. And it's not really debatable, you know. And that's true for every religion and no religion. There's very bad Christians in history, right? The Inquisition, the Crusades, you know, the Nazis even quoted the parable of the Good Samaritan. That's how twisted human beings can be. But I mean, they would sing Amazing Grace and shit, the Nazis. And it's not really in textbooks. But because there's some anti-Semitic misinterpretations of some things in the Bible. But yeah, I'm, you know, so any Christian listeners out there, like, I'm not trying to just Molotov cocktail the whole thing. I'm trying to unravel it and see as close to the real understanding as possible in a sincere way. Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
So thank you for helping me understand who the audience is and and where you've been at.
Sure. Yeah.
But yeah, you asked, why are there so many disagreements? You know, and it's like, it's because the ego, it's because of the human mind, you know, Jesus attained it, taught it. Jesus didn't write anything down. I mean, who was it? It was on something and they were like, Jesus, which Jesus didn't write, you know, whatever. And I was like, oh yeah, no, Jesus didn't write anything down. And he was like, because I think some people think like Jesus wrote the Bible, mm-hmm. you know, and it's like Jesus not only didn't write, he spoke a different language. Mm. Jesus spoke Aramaic, right? The Gospels are written in Greek. So that means that there's a translation before the first version mm-hmm. of the New Testament.
So they had to translate it, and then someone else interpreted what he was saying and then put it on paper.
Correct. And
so
it's not quite a documentary, you know. Mm-hmm. I mean, it's earliest gospel Mark is about 40 years after his death in another language. So yeah, the reporting is, you know, it's not 100%, and that's what opens up to interpretation. And then I also think I make this very brief case at the top, which is like when there's a spiritual master, a man or woman at that level, there's just this level of like inspiration and power and like tangible, you know, if you've ever, you know, been near a saint or something like that, you could almost feel, you know, there's a Hindu saint that comes here every year or so, and you just feel good around this person, you know, it's because mm-hmm. they embody this stuff. And that's what I believe, you know, that Jesus is walking, crowds form, you know, and so there's a real power. And I think that lesser men, and really in the Hindu view, what I mean by that is just like people who are ignorant of their true nature. Because I don't think there's anyone better, or higher or lower, or lesser or better than anyone else. It's just our knowledge about ourselves. You know, it's just our ignorance about our true identity. And so people that are not living in the true identity have egoic, manipulative tendencies, whatever. And that's these political guys. And they're going, we can use this. Mm-hmm. You know, this is a really strong power. Let's align it, you know, like the gospel writer, you know, Matthew's writer, what we call the Matthean author. The Matthean author says, I can use this guy's, my main character, to malign the other Jewish sects at the time, you know, and that's why you have the sectarian divisions in Matthew. So I think there's opportunists mm-hmm. that are early, and they've continued, and that's why denominational schisms, you have Protestant Catholics, you know, then you have 1,000 different Protestant branches, but we're the only one, you mm-hmm. know, mm-hmm. It's only us, our congregation of 10,000 people. We're the only one. No, you're not.
Yeah.
God is in every being, and God is in you. Yes. But it's not only you. Mm-hmm. That's the error. Hmm.
So over time, you know, if you look throughout the Bible, there's certain parts that may have been written by people with an agenda,
yeah,
so to say. So how do you think, in Christianity today, with certain people believing that the Bible is, you know, infallible, how do you think that's showing up today, you know, with people using it? Okay, well, it's infallible, this, and this. So that means that, like, do you think that that's having a negative effect? Or it obviously is, but how do you think that that's showing up today?
Pride. You know, kind of elitist exclusivity, you know, it comes back to like our books, the book, and all these other books are no good. And, you know, yeah. And even like, hey, no, everybody else is going to burn for eternity because they worship these imperfect books and we have a perfect book. I mean, it's like such a shortcut thing of like, I don't have to, it's a tightened, it's also fearful too, because it's like they're afraid to consider the potentiality that maybe there are errors in the Bible, you know, that maybe their way isn't the only true soul path. Well, what does that mean? I mean, I think for older people, it's hard because they'll say like, you know, I've spent 40 years going to church. Like I've kind of invested my life into this lie that this is the only thing, you know? And what I say to that is there's nuance to that because just because you went to church and believe that it was infallible and it's the only way, and so like you're not like canceling all that out of your own spiritual work. Like it's your life, or, you know, again, the Hindus influenced me profoundly. Like your incarnation, this incarnation, you've been doing spiritual work. You've been learning. You've been having lessons in your life. Like, it's okay that you start to question. You're getting to a point where you're hearing people like me, you're listening to Dalton's podcast, you're in this place where you're open to considering, hey, what was that quote from the Buddha? That was pretty good. You know, it's like, it's all right. And it's actually, not only is it all right, it's natural to get to this kind of developmental next phase, if you will, without being too patronizing about that. You know, and it is scary, and it's almost like what I hear from a lot of Christians who leave the church, you know, some of which is more dramatic than others, but some people have these kind of dramatic departures, and it's very challenging, and it's very painful at first. And, mm-hmm. and I empathize with that. You know, people lose friends and they lose the community, people that are really, really tied into the church. So that's really tough. But, you know, at the same time, like what I understand about all this stuff in terms of as a religious commentator, spiritual commentator, is like fear or love. It's one or the other. Every action, every word, every thought comes from fear or love. And so if you're just living in this kind of tightened, conditioned, rigid thing of, this has to be the only thing. This is my ticket to eternity. This is my da da da. Like, because you're afraid, like, I warmly invite you to just unclench the fists for a minute, you know, do some meditation, you know, check out this book called The Dhammapada by the Buddha. Go to a yoga studio, you know, that has a Hindu influence. Or, you know, if you're not there, you're not there. But or a psychedelic journey can also help that as well. Psychedelics can open you up to other things. It's okay. I mean, I think that's one of my big mantras. Like, it's all right. It's okay. It's scary at first, but come on in, you know. The water's just fine.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, what I was surprised was, shout out to The Kingdom Within. It's a great documentary, by the way.
Thank you.
Yeah, I mean, anybody who wants to watch it can find it on YouTube. But there's a few different pastors that they just have completely contradicted.
I'm really glad they're in there. Because the first kind of version of it was a bunch of yogis and like open-minded pastors. And I was at a party and this guy was like, he goes, are you getting like hardcore fundamentalist evangelical pastors? I was like, no, not really. Just kind of open-minded. And he goes, I'm not watching that. He goes, you got to get people you know, and it was so good. And I didn't know any, I knew open-minded pastors, but I didn't know any closed-minded. And so I emailed like 20 and three said, come on in. And they're all different too, because one guy is like really sweet, but he's still kind of, our way is the only way. And then another guy is like intellectual and he's hard and he's like, he's tough, but he does have like a little warm moment. And then this third guy is just like fire and brimstone from the country. It's like insane that I got this guy. He's like moonlights in the KKK. I'm really glad I got those guys. So thank you for calling that out. Yeah.
Yeah. No, I mean, it was amazing. Cause
it's a nice juxtaposition of wisdom and kind of, you know, yeah.
Yeah. It was pretty, what I loved was seeing the open-minded pastors. What I really love, I really, and I needed that because I'm like,
and they're real.
Yeah.
And they're great.
Because I have to be honest, like I realized these past couple of years, when I got a little older, I started seeing the things that some things about Christianity that I really didn't like. And I just was like, what the hell, you know, this is terrible. And like, I'm at a point now where I'm really trying to appreciate it more, and I'm not trying to be such a hater, you know, like, because, seeing pastors like that, that were so open-minded, like, you know, kind of all, like all rivers lead to the ocean kind of thing. Like, hey, I totally appreciate.
Yeah.
What was that one guy? I don't know his name. He was wearing like a black,
Father Pat. I think that's my guy. Yeah.
He was so amazing. If I'll be honest, like I didn't think that he would have those sort of views when I saw him.
Yeah.
And he was just so
shout out Father Pat Gahan.
Yeah, he was just so like any way that you find your way to God is great.
Legit.
You know, you do that. And
I what he says is, and my way is Jesus. And it's transformed my life, you know? Mm-hmm. And so that's why I'm into that. You know, he's like, I'm a priest. I'm in the church. He's been doing it his entire life. Mm-hmm. But at the same time, a Texas preacher. He's from Georgia. Mm-hmm. He's a Southern preacher in America. And he says something like, he said, because I cite in the book, so I know it exactly. He says, I don't know many mature Christians who discount other traditions' holy messengers.
Yeah.
Because who knows what God is up to? Who knows where and when he's appearing to other human beings, you know?
Right.
Did he appear in Jesus? Yes. That's all I have authority to cover. It's like,
It's a breath of fresh air. You go,
Father Pat. Absolutely.
Breath of fresh air.
Absolutely.
Definitely. Opened my mind a little bit.
Thank you. Yeah.
Yeah.
The Kingdom Within was kind of my documentary thesis in college, and it still holds up, you know. It's almost 10 years old. Mm-hmm. Came out in like 15.
Yeah. I saw you made another one about Jerusalem.
I made a feature about Palestine in 2020.
Yeah. I want to check that one out too. I haven't had the chance to yet, but I'm like so oblivious to what's going on
over there. Then it's for you. So check it out.
Exactly. Yeah.
It's called Solidarity, about the Israel-Palestine region. And I made it years before all this craziness, obviously. And I'm glad I did, because now I do know what's going on over there, kind of when the world has been forced to come to understand what's going on. I didn't go over there, which obviously, you know, is a pretty important qualifier for understanding, but I did research it for about 3 years, podcasts, books, panels, interviews, and I talked to Palestinians and Israelis in Central Texas, and that's who's in the film. And so, yeah, check it out. I'll point to it there, but free Palestine.
Yeah.
I'll say that.
Yeah.
And hey, solidarity with peace activist Israelis too. There's very good Israeli people. There's very good Israeli citizens. Not thrilled about the Israeli government or military. Praying for peace.
A passage that you highlighted in your book that I wanted to have you speak on a little bit. John 14:6.
Oh yeah. Let's do it.
I am the way, the truth, and the life. No one comes to the Father except through me.
Oh boy.
What is your interpretation of this? And before I have you answer that, actually, I want to say, like, these are all like interpretations, right? Like, oh, one thing I didn't get to, and I was telling you about my friend, I was telling my friend that you were coming on the other day, and I was like, I love this guy because he's speaking like from a perspective that I agree with. So it's almost like validating me in a sense, you know? And he's like, okay, so
you're not crazy.
He's talking about your interpretation. So that's why you want to talk to him. And I'm like, yeah, you're kind of right. You know, it's all interpretations, right? I mean, who's right, who's wrong? I mean, I don't know. But yeah, what is your interpretation?
I'll tell you the right interpretation. No, you're right. Well, and also like the truth, there's an idea within mystic philosophy that the capital T truth actually cannot be contained in form, right? It cannot mm-hmm. be contained in concepts or words because they're just symbols. They're just mouth noises. These are just audio waves that are hitting our ear bones. You know, it's like the truth is beyond the sand through the fingers, which is what the material world is. So I really honor that level of self-awareness and humility from the mystics to kind of say it's unknowable. You know, the best definition for God is ineffable, unspeakable, beyond words, which is also words. So anyway, John 14:6 is the number one comment that I get from Christians on my work on TikTok and Instagram. And right, you quoted it earlier. Jesus says, "I am the way, the truth, and the life. No one comes to the Father except through me." And there's a few things that I'll say about John and that verse in particular to help us understand the meaning. Because the interpretation of the mystics is that what he's saying is, my attainment of unconditional love, this level of seeing the one in all, which I've come to through my own practices, is the way to God. The way to the divine is unconditional love. And no one can see God except through this capacity of seeing unconditional love in all beings and having unconditional love for all beings, which I have attained. And to back that interpretation up from a scholarly standpoint, John is known as the spiritual gospel. So we talked about the synoptics earlier. Synoptics just means to be read together. Mark, Matthew, and Luke, they're much cleaner reporting, if you will. John is 100 to 120 CE. So Mark is around 70 CE. Matthew, Jesus dies in 35. Matthew is 70 to 80. Luke is 80 to 95, 85, 95. John is 100 to 120, 125. So it's much later. And even, I quote this in the book, there was an early church father named Clement of Alexandria, who was the first person to say, John is the spiritual gospel, which is kind of like it's good, and it has some gems. Don't get me wrong. There's some beautiful imagery and teaching in John. And also, it's not historical. It's not literal. It's the spiritual gospel. There's no nativity in John, for example. In the beginning was the Word. A very poetic, mystical, Gnostic opening that's in John. It exists throughout the text. So that's the first thing I'd say is John is spiritual. The second thing I'd say is when Jesus is teaching in the New Testament, it's important to understand who he's talking to. Is he talking to the large crowds? Is he talking to small groups? Or is he talking to only the disciples? Because who he's speaking to from a teacher standpoint helps you interpret what he's trying to say. So to the large crowds, to the masses, he's teaching very simply and directly. Blessed are the poor.
Love your neighbor.
Love your neighbor as yourself. Mm-hmm. He's keeping it real simple and direct. Mm-hmm. Smaller groups get the parables. They get the spiritual symbolism, but also the teaching story that helps them process and understand it, contemplate it. The disciples get the direct spiritual teaching. It's allegorical, but it's also, that's the real identity of the master that's conveyed to the student. Whereas the crowds don't understand. They're not living with him. They're not studying with him. They're not on the level that the disciples and the apostles are to be able to understand what he's trying to say. So when he says, I'm the way, the truth, and the life, he's talking to the direct disciples only. It's the transmission of the master. And that's why mystics are allowed to make that jump to say he's talking about his true identity of a conscious attainment. And right before that, he says, before Abraham was, I am. So Abraham is the ancient father of Judaism. If he's saying, I am, before Abraham was, I am, he's not talking about this man. He's not talking about this body. He's not talking about Jesus walking Galilee. He's talking about the eternal. He's talking about the timeless level of conscious awareness that he's attained. Lastly, I'd say there's plenty of other faith tradition masters who use I am statements. So the Buddha says, I am awake. Krishna says, I'm the fire of the funeral pyre. I'm the sacrificial ritual. You know, the men and women throughout history have these I am statements, and they're not talking about the body or them as individuals. And ironically, they're talking about the opposite. They're talking about the erasure of the individual. They're talking about the disappearance of the egoic identity and the vessel, because they've just become a vessel for spirit. So that's kind of my like four bullet points on why I think John 14:6 is not a commercial for Christianity. It's a very profound mystical identity share. Mm-hmm.
It's an instruction. He's almost saying, I am this way of seeing the world, and this consciousness and constantly loving and being compassionate, that's the way to God.
Exactly.
Not through me, literally.
Not Jesus. Cracker on Sunday. Sorry. No offense, everybody. Like, I realize it's personal, and you know, I'm not trying to be rude and whatever, but it's also, if you're frustrated by me saying this, I'm just as frustrated by people thinking that he was an exclusive, you know, like, sorry, you know, the televangelist preachers with private jets are wrong. And Meister Eckhart, the German mystic and theologian who interpreted Jesus in a mystical way, is right. You know, it's like, that's the hill I've died on long ago, Dalton.
Yeah, because there's just so much more that we can get out of these other practices and other teachings. And I think there's so much lost when you only, well, there's so much damage, I think, that can be done when you only follow this one book and you take it so literally.
You know, to that point real quick, I'll say, like, I think it's definitely okay and maybe even preferred to lean into one path. Mm-hmm. Ramakrishna famously said, you cannot find the water by digging many shallow wells. Mm-hmm. Dig one deep well, right? So I do believe that, like, if it's your incarnation's recipe to be a Christian, then you should be, like, really lean into Jesus. I had a friend of mine who said, you know, I love your book, and I'm kind of, his dad's a preacher, you know, it's like, I meet these people, and he was like, I'm really having trouble, like, having, like, leaving the church. And I said, you don't have to. You know, the church has the potential of being the method to get you to God. You know, lean into Jesus and, you know, the true teaching, and lean into the saints, you know, lean into the contemplative masters, men and women throughout history and Christianity who have, there's some of the best mystics in the world. I mean, Saint Francis is touched my heart many years ago. He's worth understanding deeply. But there's been some modern ones too. And, you know, that tradition is rich with, you know, being able to get you there. But to your point, it's like, but it's the tightening. Mm-hmm. It's the exclusive. It's the all screw it's everybody else.
It, like you were saying.
That's where the ego gets it. And that's not as healthy. But I definitely do think that you can get there with Christianity. And yeah, it's just, yeah, like we said, the issue is when you think you can only get there with Christianity. Mm-hmm.
Yeah, of course. I guess I'll ask this, like, how, if you were speaking to someone who wanted to start on a spiritual path, where would you recommend to sort of begin that journey?
Yeah, there's definitely, you know, a bunch of books that I love and appreciate and respect. And, you know, I think there's an intuitive answer here to that as well, which is like, listen to your heart more, you know, and meditation, like it, by quieting the mind, which Jesus did, which, you know, which is a spiritual practice in all the religious traditions. You are able to allow guidance, you know, or even I like lately I've heard the terms like suggestion, you know, you just get suggestions. You're not going to hear, go and do this, you know, but you'll get little nudges, of kind of where to go and follow that, you know, and that's kind of a fun early spiritual practice that continues. You know, I, not to be too like commercial here, but like my book is my, 5-year, basically it's my life's work, to at this point on kind of answering that question to say like what I try to do in it is to say there's some of the stuff we talked about from the Bible scholarship kind of untangling. And then there's also kind of intro to Hinduism, intro to Buddhism, insights on psychedelics, and ultimately insights on the illusion or, you know, kind of non-dual philosophy. So it does get go further and further down the rabbit hole. But what I tried to do, Dalton, in the book is really say like, I call it like the spiritual buffet line, you know, it's like, it's a sampler. It's like, this is like, get a hamburger, get a taco, get a side of fried rice and get some tiramisu. You know, it's like, they're like, just get a little sample. And then like, kind of like by the end of my book, whatever really lit you on fire or like whatever teacher I cite, modern or ancient, like then read them, you know, like I'm not the teacher. I'm definitely not the guru. But I am a billboard, you know, and I'm, it's an honor to point people, you know, some of the best compliments is like people have said, thank you for introducing me to Ramana Maharshi, for example, who was this Indian, master from the early to mid 1900s, who was this just absolute, you know, he was a Christ-like attainment in my view and many in the view of many others. You know, so there's tons of them, you know, find your, wherever your heart compass is shaking, you know, go in that direction.
Yeah. But you're saying, you know, find one path, don't dig a bunch of small.
Yeah. I think there is a, there's kind of like an exploratory phase and then there's like a settle down and dig the well phase, you know, and only, you know, when that shifts, you know, in your own intuitive understanding of yourself, you know, but yeah, I mean, I think it is healthy to kind of nibble around. And then what my teacher said one time was don't get indigestion. You know, by like just reading this book and that book and this one. And I still kind of do that, admittedly. I'm always going to have a huge stack, but.
It's just hard for you to digest one specific
thing. Yeah.
If you're focusing on so many others, is that what you mean?
The spiritual texts aren't speed reads. Mm-hmm. You know, they're designed, you know, you could read the Bhagavad Gita, you can read in a few hours. You know, it's 18 chapters and they're all like pretty short, but you'll understand it after the 20th year of reading it, you know, it's, or not 20th, you'll get it before that. You know what I'm saying? But But like Sri Yukteswar says something like, I still don't, you know, I still haven't fully grasped this verse and I've read it 1,000 times, mm-hmm. you know, mm-hmm. like that's the beauty of scripture, you know, is that it carries multiple meanings based on where you are and your awareness. So yeah, take your time in really exploring this stuff. But, you know, one that I think a good commercial for Eastern philosophy and Eastern mysticism is a guy, Ram Dass, who mm-hmm. I'm sure we talked about earlier, Beware How, Be Here Now. He was a Harvard psychologist. He was an early psychedelic kind of pioneer in America. And he met a guru in India and Maharaji Neem Karoli Bhavi came back and kind of evangelized Eastern mysticism. And he liked to say that, for example, he was like a Freudian theorist. He was a psychoanalysis, you know, Harvard psychologist. So he was like the height of American cognitive study. And he said, we thought we understood the mind more than anyone else, you know, when he was at Harvard in the 50s. And he said, and then I went and read these old scriptures from India, you know, Hindu texts and Buddhist texts. And he said, and they had more sophistication of the mind and what it does and ways around than we could have ever imagined. We thought we were the explorers and we were, you know, like they were Columbus and, you know, the Heart Sutra is on the moon. You know, it's like there's a level of like sophistication and depth in ancient, you know, a lot of the mystic traditions, but you know, I've been hypnotized by Hinduism and Buddhism for a long time and they're worth checking out.
Yeah. Yeah. Well, where can people find what you're working on right now or what you've done?
Yeah, man.
Shout out some of your work.
Thank you. Yeah. OriginalSinIsALie.com is my site that holds the stuff. And the book is Original Sin is a Lie, How Spirituality Defies Dogma and Reveals Our True Self. I'm on Instagram and TikTok, you know, decently often. Original Sin is a Lie is that. And yeah, like I said, podcast coming this year. Book will be in a few years, but this one's 300 something pages, so
awesome.
Can chew on it for a while. So, but yeah, thank you so much, man.
Yeah, of course.
Thrilled to chat with you.
Yeah, yeah, yeah. I'll put all that stuff in the show notes if you guys want to check it out. But
great.
I appreciate you coming on and talking with me, Bob.
Thank you. What a pleasure.
Yes, sir.
Namaste.
Namaste.